If you want to know how to start a business that you can actually sell, you better listen on. This is Jake Senzino, host of the Jake and Gino podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, the chef, the father, six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbagino. How's it going?
I'm doing good, brother. How you doing, Jake?
Always making it happen, big man. Gino, this is your chance to riff. Take it or I'm leaving you.
Well, this is a new one for me. You gotta let me speak before you jump into the podcast. Good, because today's guest, Jake, he's an excellent author. I mean, the world is so small. We met him through reading Small Giants, through Paul Spiegelman's book, through, you know, Bo Burlingham's book. And I love the books that he has. They're called Built to Sell, and we have The Automatic Customer here. And in the book Built to Sell, there's a person named Alex Stapleton. He's the person in the story in Built to Sell. And as I was reading the book, Jake, I was thinking about myself, the pizza guy back in 2010. And I was saying to myself, John Warlow, where were you back in 2010? I needed you because I was Alex Stapleton at the restaurant. I was doing everything. I was a jack of all trades and I was master of none. Where were you when I needed the continuity product? I could have had like a subscription site. I didn't know any of this stuff 10, 12 years ago. And if I had done it, I would have been able to sell my business for 3X. But not even that. I would have made a more self-sustaining business. I would have created a business with impact. I would have been able to create an enduring business. And I wish I had read this stuff so much sooner. So for all of you out there that are about to listen to the show, really, I mean, it's excellent. The content that John has in his books, at his website, the stuff that he teaches, or for entrepreneurs who really want to create a process and are getting into the business to create an awesome organization that ultimately one day you can exit at a 5X or a 10X multiple and not just go out there and create a job for yourself. Because that's what I did in effect for 20 years being at the restaurant. I created a really decent paying job. I always like to say I was the highest paid dishwasher in New York State. That's what I was. And when I tried to exit it, it's like, okay, what do I got? I got a few, you know, a few recipes. I got a couple hundred grand in sales, but I don't have a process. Who's buying this? And I think the book really opened my eyes to say, how do we create that kind of organization that once we're working into it, we're not just creating a job, we're creating value. But at the end of the day, when we're ready to sell, there's something that we can sell that somebody can actually buy and be proud of buying.
Wow, Gino, well said. I'm going to give the 13-second formal approach, and then we're going to get into it. So as Gino said, today's guest is the founder and CEO of The Value Builder System and the author of 3 best-selling books. His latest is titled The Art of Selling Your Business, Winning Strategies, and Secret Hacks for Exiting on Top, Not on the Bottom, as the G-Dad said. So without further ado, John Warlow, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Little long-winded there, but please share with us your background and how you got started in business.
Wow. So, I mean, I got started in business after college, but my introduction to the concept of building to sell was a meeting I had with an M&A professional. I was running a quantitative market research business. We had $5 or $6 million in annual revenue, and I decided that I wanted to sell it. And this was a profitable business. We probably put 20-25% EBITDA margins against the bottom line. So we probably had a seven-figure sort of bottom line, low seven-figure bottom line. And I kind of went into this M&A professional's office, this guy named Perry Miele in Toronto. And I kind of was rubbing my hands together saying, okay, what do you think it's worth? And he said, well, it kind of depends on the answer to a couple of questions. I said, shoot, you know, feeling all cocky and proud. And he said, well, you know, you got this market research business. And I'm like, yeah. He's like, okay, well, who does the research? And I said, well, I'm involved in some of the research. And he said, okay, well, who does
strike
the selling?
One?
Yeah, strike one. And then he said, who does the selling? And I, you know, I came clean and said, because we worked with very large customers, Microsoft, Bank of America. And I said, well, I'm out there. I'm the kind of main sales guy. And he said, okay, well, John, I can't sell your company. There's nothing to sell here. And it's worthless. And I remember him saying the words worthless, and it was just, you know, it was devastating for me because, again, I walked in there thinking, here we are, you know, multi-million dollar company, seven-figure bottom line, got to be, you know, I got to be able to get 8x EBITDA for this thing. And he's like, there's nothing to sell. It's you. It's just a glorified job. I felt like, you know, Gino, your description really resonated with me. And so he kind of went on and schooled me about what it takes to build a sellable company, you know, recurring revenue. It takes me getting out of the selling, creating a process, a system that other people can sell and deliver so that it's not dependent on you. Anyway, long story short, I changed the business around. Ultimately, we put in a recurring revenue model. We got me out of doing the selling. We created a system. It was ultimately acquired by a New York Stock Exchange listed company years later. So it has sort of a happy ending, but that moment in Perry's office really kicked off a journey for me, which has continues to this day, really trying to understand what it is that drives the value of a company and how do you maximize the value of a company. And again, to your point, Gino, whether you want to sell it or not is kind of irrelevant, but what do you do to maximize its value? And that's really what I spend my time on today.
That's awesome. I wasn't sure what questions to start out with. I mean, this could be like a 7-hour conversation for me, but I promise only 45 minutes here. The first one, what drives value? Let's have the pizza guy understand what his business is worth. How do you drive value, or what drives value in a business?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think the first step is you have to put yourself in the shoes of the acquirer and say, what am I buying? And I think what you're buying is a business that can succeed without the owner. So if you, Gino, the pizza guy, are leaving and selling the business, what am I inheriting? What am I buying? Is everything dependent on Gino? Because Gino knows the customers. Gino's the ones that gets, you know, they're loyal to Gino and the way he makes pizza. And so as a result of that, Gino leaves, there's nothing left. And that's that's the definition of a worthless business. The opposite is a business that can thrive without its owner, that's not dependent on the owner, that the operations of the business can continue. And so recurring revenue is obviously to people who own apartments, this is like music to their ears, but even people who own entrepreneurial businesses, this is the secret sauce that allows you to answer the question, this business will continue without me. Because if you've got recurring revenue, people on a pay on subscription or annual contract, the implication is that they're going to continue that into the future when you leave. So if there's one sort of piece of raw material that you want to put in place you've really got to figure out that recurring revenue model. I think that's probably the first step in really trying to create a business that can thrive without you as the owner.
Let's understand what the typical acquirer looks like and what that avatar looks like. Because I think if we can understand who they are and what's important to them, we can reverse engineer this. So what does the typical acquirer look like and what's most important to them?
Yeah, for sure. There's three types. The first is an individual investor. This is typically someone who's buying themselves a job. They've left a corporate job. They maybe gotten downsized. This is happening a lot lately as all these, you know, Microsoft and others are laying people off. They're coming, they've got money in their jeans and they're saying, I want to move to Boulder. I want to move to San Diego. I'm going to buy a business. And so they're looking to buy a job effectively. And so the more systematized your business is, the easier it is for them to learn, the more they can borrow money using an SBA loan to buy your company, the more likely they are to buy that business. And so again, they're likely to have to borrow some money. And so in order for the bank to approve that loan, you're going to want to have systems. The business is going to want to have recurring revenue so that the bank can say, yeah, the business will likely survive the change of ownership. That's the first group and they're individual investors. They typically buy businesses for less than $3 or $4 million. The second group are private equity investors. Private equity investors right now are rolling up just about every industry. They are financial engineers. They are buy low, sell high guys and gals. They are effectively trying to buy a business, stitch it together with other businesses and sell it for a higher multiple. So I did a podcast called Built to Sell Radio where I interview entrepreneurs who've sold their company. I interviewed a guy who just sold his veterinary clinic. And he sold to a private equity group that was rolling up veterinary clinics. And the private equity group was, you know, buying private veterinary groups at, you know, 6, 7, 8x EBITDA. But collectively with the you know, scale of the business that it got to, they ultimately went on to sell the entire collection of businesses at something like 25
as times a medical EBITDA. Group. When you say rolling it up, is it become a medical group?
That's correct.
Scale? Okay.
That's correct. Yeah. So the veterinary practices share one local resource for booking appointments,
human resources,
one website.
I love
HR,
it.
Yeah. So the private equity group makes their money in two or three different ways. Number one, they buy low, sell high. So they buy your business for usually less than it might be worth, or they attempt to do that. And then they're going to go sell it downstream. And they get a higher multiple because they aggregate multiple businesses. So bigger companies sell for better multiples. So the bigger the business, the better the multiple. So they get a lift there. They also get more efficiencies. So the bigger the company, they can have shared resources and get more efficiencies, efficiencies in the company. They can also get raw materials at a discount because they've got more buying power. And so that's how they make money, and they use debt in order to buy your business. And again, private equity groups are trying to understand how to get, they need to apply debt to your business. And so the more bankable your company is, the more debt they can get, the more they can pay you for your company. So again, bankable businesses have recurring revenue and they're not dependent on their owner. And private equity groups usually buy companies with at least $1 million of EBITDA. So call it 10 millions of top line revenue is usually where they start to get interested. They've gone down market from there in certain situations, especially if they're doing a roll up, but most of the time they're looking for relatively big companies. So again, call it 10 million on the top, 1 million on the bottom. And then the third group are strategic acquirers. So they're buying something that your business can do for them. So good example of that, I interviewed Jay Steinfeld. Jay Steinfeld started Blinds.com. Home Depot bought Blinds.com. Now, why did Home Depot do that? Number one, they wanted to be number one in the blinds category. But the second reason Home Depot bought Blinds.com was that at the time of the acquisition, Home Depot had $90 billion worth of revenue. Most of it done through a store. And they were trying to get more people to buy on HomeDepot.com, their website. And what Blinds.com had figured out was the secret sauce for selling complicated products that needed to be installed on a website. And so HomeDepot.com said, well, if we buy blinds, not only do we get the company, but we also get all of the intellectual capital around how to sell complicated products on a website. And so they said, look, if we can move 10% of our revenue from a store to our website, well, that'll save us X $100 million per year. So it's worth us buying Blinds.com. That's the definition of a strategic acquisition, where your company ends up being worth more to an acquirer in their hands than it is in your hands as the owner. And as you might imagine, the strategic acquirer will typically pay the most for a company because, again, they've got more to gain from buying your business. So kind of from generally the lowest bidders to the highest bidders, it would go individual investors, private equity groups to strategics.
To the premium.
General, to premium multiple.
The interesting thing, what you said about the veterinary clinics, was that it really is a duplication of what you saw with the private practice doctors around 2000 to 2010, where they all got rolled up into medical groups for strategic, alignment, better insurance pays, yada, yada, yada. And they're like, well, hey, this worked for regular doctors. Let's move on to the vets now and see if we can't, find some boost there as well.
Yeah. I mean, it was a license to print money really for these private equity groups that rolled up industries. Yeah. You name an industry, bike shops, SEO companies, car dealerships, virtually every industry.
There'll be no mom and pops left.
Yeah. Matt, pizza shops. I mean, you name the industry, there is a private equity group doing a roll up. And again, the math here is, and again, your guys are into apartment investing and they understand math and return on equity and so forth. So let's just do the math for a private equity acquisition. So let's imagine a $10 million revenue business. They're going to buy, let's just for round numbers, say they're going to buy it for $10 million. So they'll put a couple million dollars of equity in. So that's their equity in. They'll probably then borrow another $5 or $6 million from a bank. So that's levered. And then they'll get the owner of the business to roll 20, 30% of the equity into a new entity, meaning essentially take equity in the business that they used to own 100% of, retain 20 or 30%
to keep them on board as well, to help
keep them on board, keep them involved in the transition. So that $10 million business goes on to be worth $30 million 5 years down the road. Well, on one hand, you say, okay, well, they've tripled their investment. Yes. And remember, all they did was put in $2 million
yes.
because they levered the rest of it and got the owner to finance a part of it as well. And so it was, as long as things were going well, as long as they were increasing the value of the company and debt was cheap, I mean, you couldn't go wrong. It was virtually impossible for them to lose, which is why so much money flew into private equity. It became the sexiest, hottest asset class around. Now there's so much money sloshing around private equity groups that it's lost a lot of its alpha, a lot of its ability to make money. Number one. Number two, interest rates have gone up. And so now the free, cheap money has become more expensive, and the business model has changed very dramatically. So it is affecting it, but there was a time when you virtually couldn't lose as a private equity group.
John, you must get a lot of pushback from people like Jake and Gino who never sell. I'm not going to sell my apartment complex. I'm going to keep that future stream for the next 20 years. You know, tell the listeners why they should position their business, even if they don't want to sell. Jake and Gino don't want to sell. Jake's going to give it to his great grandkids. That's what he's going to do. He's Yellowstone. He's Kevin Costner of Yellowstone. He's going to give
man,
that
I really
crap
am
to
a
his great,
prick.
Great, great, great grandkids. I mean, like that's what he's doing. So yeah,
Beth's number.
He just pegged me. Dude, I think I'm married to her. She's kind of little feisty.
That's funny. Yeah, it's a great point, you know, because, you know, not many people want to sell their business. In fact, I'll sometimes do talks to entrepreneurial groups, EO groups and so forth. And I'll, for fun, at the very beginning of the talk, I'll say, okay, I'm the guy who wrote Built to Sell. So how many guys want to sell your business? And I'll just get you to raise your hand. And like nobody's hand goes up in the air, right? and then I say, okay, let me ask you a different question. How many would like to know that you could sell your business if and when you're ready? And like the entire audience goes up in the air, right? Because I think we all want to know, you know, when you get the 401k statement at the end of the month, you look at it, and you want the number to go up. And the same thing could be true. I could say, well, what are you planning to retire? And of course they'll say, no, but like, I'd like to know that the value of my assets are going up. Equally, when a home sells on your street, you're probably kind of curious, well, what did it sell for? Why? Because you want to sell your house? No, but you probably know that when you are ready to sell your home, you'd like to know the value of your home is going up. The other thing I would say is, Gino, like life happens, and a sellable company is the ultimate insurance policy. If you've got a company that doesn't depend on you, you've got leverage, and that's an asset you could sell. And as much as people say, oh, I love what I do, I love being a mentor for the young people in my company, I love going to work every day, I'm inspired by our business, all that's great until you get hit by a car, till you get in the hospital because you had a heart attack, because your wife was diagnosed with, or your husband was diagnosed with XYZ horrible disease. And all of a sudden, you need to liquefy that asset. You cannot continue to run it. And that's when people really get into trouble. The two most common reasons that entrepreneurs sell their company, number one is they get approached to buy it by an acquirer. Number two, they have some sort of health scare. And in both of those situations, you as the entrepreneur, whether you're getting approached by an acquirer or you have some sort of health event, in both cases, you're on your back foot. You're reacting. You're, you know, it's a fire sale situation where you just have to get a little money out because you haven't prepared, you haven't got a business that can sell. And that's what I see a lot, is people who just think, oh yeah, like, you know, when I'm ready to sell, I'll worry about all these things that go into building a sellable company. It doesn't work that way. You have to build one along the way. And the final thing I'll say on this one, Gino, is that, like, frankly, a sellable company that's not dependent on you is way more fun to run, because it's, you know, you're not involved in the minutia, the customer complaints, the you know, closing up at night, the like doing the dishes if you're running a pizza shop. Like, you're not doing the stuff you don't want to do because you've got structure and people in place to do the stuff. And that allows you to kind of cherry pick the projects and the stuff that you want to do. frankly. And it's all
he was a different person when he was. I met him when he was in the back doing the dishes, and he'd be in the back corner just staring out over the restaurant, arms crossed, looking like he was going to kill somebody. And now he's like this happy go lucky. Oh, John, so happy to meet you today. He's outgoing. Total change in the human that is Gino by getting him out of the kitchen. So it can do so much for the person. It's insane based on what you're saying here. It's crazy.
I don't even know what to say. That's a mischaracterization a little bit. I wasn't that
Dude,
much.
Are
a
you
prick.
Kidding me?
I was a little bit of a prick. You know, that's my next.
No, you were angry. I don't think you're a prick. I think you're in a bad spot.
Well, right? You know what it is? The problem is when you get in that situation, you're washing the dishes. You see your brother jumping around, going to barbecues, hanging out with Jake Senziano, going, bro, why are you drinking bourbons over there when I'm washing dishes? This shit ain't fair, Jake. You're killing me here. How do I get out of this situation? So, John, the question is, how does Gino sit in the back with pizza stains, washing dishes? How does he start? Other than reading these two books, honestly, I mean, this automatic customer book is amazing. How do I start by building that business that ultimately turns Gino from being a prick to being the happy Gino?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to have the discipline to do one thing better than anybody else. And so the challenge that a lot of entrepreneurs face is we start to become like an inch wide and a mile deep. In other words, we other way around, a mile wide and an inch deep, meaning we start to sell lots of things to a few customers. Customers start to ask us to customize things, sell a different product, provide a different service. And all of a sudden we're wandering way outside of our strike zone of what we're really good at. And we end up with a business that only you know how to run, only you can deliver because you've got no system in place and you're way, way, way outside of your comfort zone. And so what I would say is that you've got to zero in on one thing that you can systematize. I'll give you an example. There was a photographer who did all sorts of different photography, right? Weddings, like not funerals, weddings, like baseball teams.
I'm sure they're
all
out
this
there.
Stuff. What's that?
I'm sure they're out there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Funeral photographers.
But anyways, this photography company was doing all sorts of things, none of them well. And they decided to focus in on doing school photographs. So school photographs were ones they could systematize. They didn't have to have a fancy photographer to take the school photograph, put the short kids in the front, tall kids in the back, and it's an easy shot to take. They created what they call the 8-minute formula, which is this basically like formulaic way to get kids from the auditorium back into the from the classroom back into the auditorium, take the picture, and back into the classroom in 8 minutes. So, you know, principals and schools loved them because they weren't, kids weren't milling around the hallways. They're waiting for their shot. They were in and out very quickly. So they had a bit of a formula and they created this system that they taught young photographers to deliver. And so they could build a company that was not just doing odds, odds and sods photographs. They were actually building a system. So they focused on only school photographs and they're called the School Photography Company. They're based in Danbury, England. And they built a business that's gone well beyond just the founders, just the photographers, because they've had the courage to do one thing. And I think that's probably the first step in systematizing is to do one thing. And I use this analogy or this acronym called TVR, teachable, valuable, repeatable. So you're looking for a service or a product that meets those three criteria. So it's got to be teachable to employees to deliver, valuable to customers, so it can't be a commodity, and repeatable, meaning customers have to need it on a recurring basis. So teachable, valuable, repeatable. And I think what most people do when they go through that process is that the things that are most teachable are least valuable in the eyes of the customer. They're most commoditized effectively. And then the opposite is also true. The things that are most valuable are really hard to teach. And so the mistake most entrepreneurs make is they say, okay, well, we're going to focus on what we're really good at, our most valuable thing over here. And we're going to try to create systems and SOPs and processes to get employees to deliver it. And that's virtually impossible. It's the biggest mistake I see entrepreneurs make trying to apply this TVR to their business, is trying to make what's valuable teachable. And instead, you want to do exactly the opposite. You want to figure out something that is teachable, and make it more valuable in the eyes of the customer. And the way you do that is through marketing. You create a marketing layer or wrapper around that teachable service that differentiates it in the eyes of a customer.
The 8-minute photo or whatever you said.
The 8-minute photo as an example. Okay. There's a business based in Dayton, Ohio that has the 1-minute flooring system. They install floors, which is a fairly basic rudimentary service, but they have a whole system around it, right? They come into your garage, they take out all the stuff inside your garage and in a truck, put it in a cube van. They come and install a new floor in your garage. Then they come back and put it all back in place based on photographs they took. They've got a formula. It's called the 1-day flooring system, and they do it all in 1 day. And so you could just say, well, generically they install floors, but no, that's not what they've chosen to do. They've figured out something they can teach, which is installing floors. They can teach technicians and young people how to do the work, but they've got a wrapper, a brand around it called 1-day flooring. And so that's an example. The 8-minute photography example is another example. So you want to focus on what you can teach others to deliver and put a marketing wrapper around it that makes it look
four-hour work week.
4-hour work week. Yeah, that's another example.
So in the book, Built to Sell, John, you give the example of Alex Stapleton. He builds the logo design. He's all over the place. He's like Gino. I'm selling Osso Buco. I'm selling chicken parm. I'm selling pizza. I'm selling focaccias. I'm doing barbecues. I'm doing catering events. I'm doing food trucks. I am all over the place. So when what I'm hearing, Gino, the pizza guy, should have just gotten his focaccia sandwiches because they're kick-ass. They're teachable to employees. They're really easy. There's a ton of value because they are delicious, right? And they're repeatable because you want to come in 2 or 3 days a week to get them. Very simple process. I can't get rid of the chicken parm because then Jake would be pissed at me. He'd never come back and eat at the restaurant. So I got to figure out a few of those things. But for anybody listening, seriously, I mean, there's a process right there. The book talks about it and has an amazing story. And then you blend in the systems that you need, how he hires the sales team, how he hires the creative, and how he's really good at it.
And you franchise it.
Yeah, exactly. And all of a sudden, Alex becomes really good at it and people start referring his business and he's delivering it much better. And then he has a process. And then when somebody comes and says, I want to buy your business, well, here, you're not buying Alex Stapleton, the logo guy. You're buying Alex Stapleton's company without Alex. That's why the book is really powerful. But I want you to go over just maybe one or two tips in the book before we go to the short answers, because you have 17 tips in the book. What would you say is really, really important or impactful for the listener to start utilizing?
Yeah, I mean, one of the trivial little ones is again, one of the, what I have found is that entrepreneurs fall into one of two buckets. They're either delivery guys and gals or they're sales guys and gals. And what I mean by that is they're either front of the house or back of the house. So they're you know, in a restaurant context, they're either doing, they're the rainmaker for their company. They're the salesperson for their company, or they're delivering the product, doing the work, et cetera. And I find that most entrepreneurs will fall into one of those two buckets. And more often than not, it's the rainmaker. It's the salesperson. It's the front, you know, guy or gal who builds the business. And so one of the other tips is look, you've got to get yourself out of doing the selling. And that's another reason you want a formula, a standardized process, for example, because salespeople thrive on having a productized service, something that is specific that they can sell again and again and again. So that's one thing. The other thing that I would say is don't make the mistake of hiring one salesperson. And so when a lot of entrepreneurs try to make this change, they'll hire a salesperson and they'll give them the entire territory of the world, say, go sell. And that salesperson then is really, it's hard to distinguish between what inbound sales you would have gotten organically versus what they actually created, because you're getting all the leads, number one. Number two, they've got the entire world as a territory. And so what you're going to want to do is build your sales team to multiple people. And then you're in a situation where you're having to remove territory from a salesperson. So my suggestion is that you first territorialize your sales area. So you figure out if you're in Dayton, Ohio, you break it up into 4 sales territories, for example, and you tell anyone you hire, your intention is to hire multiple salespeople to cover this market. And if you can possibly do it, hire 2 salespeople, not just one. And the reason for that is that salespeople thrive on competition. And all of a sudden, you're able to tease out what is organically coming in and they would have gotten anyways versus what they've actually stimulated. You can see what a benchmark.
They went out and got it. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. You can see what a fair benchmark is for a sales organization when you've got multiple people. So get yourself out of doing the selling, systematize so there's something to sell, and then make sure you hire more than one salesperson, because that way you can really distinguish between what you're getting organically versus actually what is the added value of having a salesperson.
Yeah, it's fantastic advice. All right, gang, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor. A question, Gino, and I get a lot is, what's a great value add?
You've just closed a deal and you're looking for a way to maximize the attractiveness of your complex to potential renters.
At Rand Property Management, we start at the bottom. Literally, we start with the flooring.
And that means we start with a call to Christian Chapman and his team at David's Abbey Carpet and Flooring. No one wants to deal with the expense and hassle of putting in new floors, and that is exactly why we turn to David's Abbey.
David's Abbey Carpet and Flooring provides a quality, long-lasting product at a great price. The wear layer and waterproofing that comes standard with all David Abbey products will ensure you are on solid ground for years to come.
My favorite part of working with Christian and his team is convenience. David's Abbey will direct ship their product anywhere in the U.S., That's white glove service, folks.
And your installation team will love how easy it is to install. The next time that you're looking for a great value add, give our friends at David's Abbey Carpet and Flooring a call and speak with Christian.
Or click the link in the show notes to visit their website today.
All right, we are back and we're going to stay with the scaling here for a second. So folks that are the solopreneur, they got the logo business, they got the consulting business, and they realize that the business is dependent on them. What is the first step to scaling? What is the first thing they need to do to get out of their own way?
Yeah, I mean, I think niching down is a trite old expression that we've all heard before, but I do believe it is the first step in this process, because what you'll find is when you start to niche down and really start to isolate the ideal customer, the person that really values what it is that you do, you start to get a homogeneous pain point, like something that all of those customers experience. And when you do that, you can start to create a productized service that all of those customers will want. Again, the enemy of scale is customization, right? You say, Gino, well, we're just going to do the focaccia sandwiches and we're going to become the world, but we can't get rid of this chicken parm. What I'm saying is exactly the opposite. I'm saying that, yeah, you need to get rid of the chicken parm.
Kill the chicken parm.
Because the moment you kill, you know, you keep the chicken parm, now you've increased the complexity of your business by a factor of exponential as opposed to linear. Now we've got to have different chefs. We've got to have different ingredients. We've got to have different supply chains to make sure we've got the chicken parm ingredients. We got to have the ovens at a different temperature. We got to have a different opening procedure. We got to have a different closing. Like, the complexity just exploded because you didn't have the courage to turn off the chicken parm.
I don't want and Jake to beat me happens, up. That's why. Jake's going to beat me up. He's not going to come back.
And that happens all the time. That's a trivial little example.
You got to let Jake go, baby.
We all want to, we don't ever want to look into the eyes of a customer and say,
no,
we're not supplying that service anymore. We're not offering that product anymore. But that's the price of scale. It's the price of actually doing some of this stuff, to going from having a glorified job to having a business you own and could sell. The price is focus on one thing. And the only way you're going to get there, I believe, is to niche down your target audience to a point where you get to a homogeneous need, right? So in the case of the focaccia sandwiches, it's probably a different customer. It's probably a guy who's on the road who comes in, who needs a quick lunch, wants to, you know, like, then the person, again, I don't know anything about running a restaurant, you know, so please correct me.
You're doing
me,
good, but, man.
But my point is that regardless of what business you're in, you're going to want to niche down to a very, very specific type of person and find a group of people who have the same need. And that's your target segment onto which you can start building some of the things we talked about, recurring revenue, productized service, et cetera.
You actually nailed it, actually. When I'm thinking about it, business is different 30 and 40 years ago. I opened the restaurant with my dad. Supply chains were different. Profit margins were different. Everything was completely different. And back then, I think you could have served more. There was less competition as well. I mean, when he opened up back in the 70s, people really didn't go out and eat. It wasn't a thing. So it was a different kind of experience. Now, as you're niching it down, there's so much competition and you want to become a specialist at something. There's so many places for you to go and eat. And I was just brought up in the restaurant that you have to have osso buco and you also have to have chicken nuggets for your, I mean, it was just a crazy concept. And I had to extricate myself from that situation and say, Dad, we're not doing this anymore. I'm going to go do apartments. And I think the apartment space and multifamily has allowed me to say, oh, wow, the residents, this is what they want. And oh, monthly recurring revenue. We have pet fees. We have late fees. We have, application, all these different kinds of fees. I can see it so much clearly in this business. And now when I look back, I could have implemented that in the restaurant business. I was just with somebody who, you know, I would say he's my father, but he was my mentor. We got into the business. It was just a different way of doing it. And continuing to do that was just the death spiral for me. And it would have just led to the death spiral. So, I mean, I think that information is completely spot on.
Yeah, I think, as I said before we hit record, I don't know much about real estate investing. What I do know is I feel like it's a great business to grow your capital. And it's hard for a very young or new entrepreneur to get in because they need that first, unless they've got wealthy parents or they've got someone willing to lend them the money, that first rung on the wealth ladder to establish buy their first apartment or whatever. And I think some of the things we're talking about today can be really powerful for that first business. If you can build a business, create some systems and sell it and get the capital to then get into a more capital intensive business like apartments, for example. Like, and again, it doesn't have to be, I talk to my kids about this all the time. It doesn't have to be a super sexy business. You can take a very boring, like lawn care as an example. All you need is a lawnmower to get your feet on the ground. You build out a network, you come up with some unique way that you market and position your lawn care. You build out a team of people who can cut the lawns and you build it to $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 in recurring revenue. That's a business you can sell. And it's probably a business you can sell for a few hundred grand, which is enough to get into the apartment business. You know what I mean? Like you can take some of the things we talked about today and build a business, sell it, and have the capital to get into a more capital intensive space as well.
You know way more about apartment investing than you'll ever realize. And it's because of your private equity experience. And what we saw from 2021 to 2022, the amount of private equity that came into the multifamily space was insane. Huh. It drove down cap rates, drove up prices, because all the people that were out there syndicating deals, wherever the money was coming from, was basically going in, doing syndications and 3.5% debt. We'll take it, right? The debt is so cheap. And then the prices went up and up and up. And people were flipping like every 8 months, flipping out to someone else. And they're like, hey, 20% rent increase, boom, 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 boom. And that's where they're forecasting for. So it was a wild 2 years. And for the long-term Yellowstone stodgy buyers like Gino and myself, it was painful. And literally, you know, you go to, I don't know if it was December or whatever, but the lights went off and all of a sudden these deals start coming out of the woodwork that we like to buy again. And so we're back in the saddle a little bit, but that's a market cycle. And that's kind of what we do. So going back to the private equity, what do you see the opportunities for folks in 2023? Where are people shifting? You know, where's the money flowing to?
Yeah. I mean, look, the private equity groups, again, if you think about how they make their money and their model work, it is debt. And so
cheap
what
debt.
They,
yeah.
What's that?
Yeah. Cheap debt. It makes it even nicer, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Cheap debt is great, but even market rate debt today is what they need to make the economics of their business work. And so increasingly they are looking for profitability companies that cash flow because they've got to pay back the debt. So they need cash flow. There was a time when, you know, there was a real priority being placed on top line revenue growth. And if you didn't make a lot of money, well, that's okay because the money is free effectively. The debt is so cheap that it didn't really matter. Today, the spoils are going to, or the deals are happening when businesses are profitable and growing. So that the focus is now a little bit more on the bottom line and less on the top line. Although top line is always going to be important. It doesn't, the kind of bottom line profitability is now sort of a table stake in the space. That's probably one, you know, big driver. And a lot of these, you know, it's kind of like a game of musical chairs, you know, like a lot of these industries have rolled up now, right? So the big medical clinic ones, the vet clinic, the dental practices, like those are done. The deals are getting harder to do because a lot of the independent folks have sold out. So, you may have missed a bit of a cycle, if you will, if you're trying to unload like a single business. There may be opportunities, but I think it's less than it was, say, a year ago.
That's exactly how we look at our business. We look for 20% top line growth year over year, and then we look for a PPU, which is profit per unit, which represents our bottom line. And so we strive to hit a PPU and a 20% top line growth. Keep it very simple, and everyone knows kind of where we're going, and it provides alignment throughout the organization. So appreciate That's you right. saying that. Yeah. Book recommendations, anything that you've read in the last few years that added value to your life that you care to share with the folks?
Great question. Well, we were originally connected through Bo Burlingham, who wrote the book Small Giants, which is a wonderful book. I would highly recommend folks Love read that, that if they haven't. It's a great book. And it really, I find reading it is you can kind of exhale because, you know, we are so socialized, I think, as entrepreneurs to really focus on grow, grow, grow. Got to be on the Inc. 500. Got to be the fastest growing in my state or my city, whatever. Like, there's this real sort of ethos about grow at all costs. And what I think that book does is say, yeah, growth's fine, but there's another whole set of factors that you may want to consider in building your company. And I think it's a very refreshing read.
That's exactly how I felt after reading it. I felt like I could breathe. And that's why we set the 20%, because we're not competing with Joe Asshole down the road or so-and-so who's done this, or they posted this on social media. No, we know internally that 20%, we don't get out over our skis at 20%. It's sustainable. It's fantastic for profitability. So we set that metric, and then everything else we're good with. If we hit our 20%, we're extremely happy. It goes beyond that. Fantastic. As long as the business is not unraveling, because we can't scale as we're growing. So that's exactly my thoughts. Gino, how'd you feel after you read it? Was that similar for yourself or?
It was a great book because it gave me clarity, and I don't want to be the next Facebook. I don't want to be the next private equity person. We have 1600 units. If we can close between 300 and 400 units a year of really profitable units and be able to do that, and in 5 years, look back and go, wow, we've got 3000 units. Who'd have thought about it? And it just gives you clarity on what you're trying to accomplish. And I think we're all different, but for the most part, most people out there don't want to become the next Facebook. That's what most entrepreneurs just want to have an enduring organization. They want to create impact, and they want to get really good at what they're doing. And I think that book just allowed me and you to say, well, okay, great. We don't want to be the next 10,000 unit person. We want to just buy these deals. We want to let our investors partake in our deals, and we want our employees to be able to actually start, sharing in the profits as well. So how do we do that? And for us, just worrying about scaling up and not having to scale up too quickly was really important. And like you said,
we don't need to benchmark ourselves against Blackstone. We're good and very comfortable and profitable with what we're doing, and we're happy with that. Yeah,
mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah. What is the best way, John, for folks to get a hold of you and work with you?
Yeah, I mean, head over to builttosell.com is where, you'll find all the last episodes of Built to Sell Radio, the podcast, the blog, the books. That's probably the best place to go, builttosell.com.
Gino, very enjoyable one here. Are you going to take us home?
I would like to wrap this up by thinking back of a young John Warlow walking into his broker's office saying, I want to sell my business. I'm making 7 figures a year. I'm crushing it. How much can I get?
Show me the money.
And the answer is goose eggs, my friend. You got nothing. Are you going to sell yourself? Are you going to pimp yourself out? Because basically that's all you can sell, right? And he comes back home and he says to himself, how do I figure this out? How do I make my business more profitable? Oh, I've got to start scaling up and implementing systems. And I think that was the birth of the Built to Sell of all this content. And how I think, to me, when you read these books, if you're an entrepreneur and you've been doing what I've been doing for the last several years, where I was working, everyone's saying working in the business. I think these books will allow you to work on the business and create true value. And even if you don't want to sell, it's great. We're long-term buy and holders. Have a plan. Be able to say, I want to go on vacation for a month. Let me leave the business to somebody for a few weeks. Give yourself that luxury to say, because I think the thing that makes a person the most happy is when they have the autonomy, when they have the ability to say, I want to sell, but I don't have to yet. And that's what I think, John is built here by being able to have people start structuring their business in his format, in that system that he puts through in his books.
Well said, Gino. Gang, as always, we believe in buying deals for the long term. Think in decades. I'm Jake, he's the G Daddy, and we make it happen. John, thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, guys.